Diverse, independent, yours. You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, British Columbia.
Welcome to Guerrilla Radio, recorded April 24th and 25th, 2024. Last week, the United States surprised no one in using its veto power in the United Nations Security Council to stymie again Palestine's hopes of recognition as a full member state. In killing the resolution, a reiteration of another aborted by that body in 2011, America said, quote, "This vote does not reflect opposition to Palestinian statehood, but instead is an acknowledgement that it will only come from direct negotiation between the parties." That presumably an allusion to Israel, the UN member state currently waging a widely acknowledged genocide across Palestine's remnant historical territories. John B. Quigley is Professor Emeritus of International Law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law, whose numerous publications include books on international jurisprudence and articles on human rights, the United Nations, war and peace, East European law, African law, and the Arab-Israeli conflict. In his book, The Statehood of Palestine, International Law in the Middle East Conflict, Quigley argues the state of Palestine was extant before Israel's creation and remains so despite any subsequent permutation to its territory. Some of Quigley's other titles include The Case for Palestine in International Law Perspective, Palestinian Crisis Best Understood Under International Law, International Law and the Palestinian Refugees, and The Statehood of Palestine, among others. John B. Quigley in the first half. And following the UN Security Council's quashing of the full membership resolution for Palestine, an emboldened Israel accelerated its genocide campaign against the captive Gaza, and though famine, disease, and the entire strip is being subject to land and air bombardment, the international community has proven unable to either stop the onslaught or get adequate food and other aid to the people there. But not everyone is waiting for the UN or international community to act. Activist, journalist, and lawyer Dimitri Lascaris has joined the Gaza Freedom Flotilla 2024 in Turkey, where the three-ship-strong contingent has expedited its departure to, quote, meet the profound and urgent needs of Gaza's civilian population. Dimitri Lascaris taking to the high seas in defense of Palestine in the second half. But first, John Quigley and the making of the state of Palestine now as it's ever been again. Welcome to the program, John.
Thank you very much.
Well, now, John, in its most recent denial of Palestine's proper acceptance into the UN's family of nations, America's representative said that his country does not oppose Palestinian statehood. John, is there any empirical evidence to suggest the United States ever has been a proponent for that?
Well, the United States has taken positions in the past that actually do incline in the direction of accepting Palestine as a state. It was done by someone who, well, you may find this a bit surprising, George W. Bush, when he was president, promoted something called the Roadmap for Peace that said that if the Palestinians would renounce violence, that within a couple of months, the United States would ask states of the world to recognize Palestine as a state. Now, what the Biden administration people said on the 18th of April in the Security Council was not that the United States accepts Palestine as a state, but rather that it will accept it as a state only in the context of a comprehensive peace agreement with Israel. And of course, Israel has said it's not going to enter into a comprehensive peace agreement with Palestine that would involve the acceptance of Palestine as a state. So the statement in the Security Council on April 18th, while it sounded like a statement that would eventually accept Palestine as a state, in reality, was putting a condition on that wasn't going to come to pass.
Well, it sounds exactly the same, that the same thing as George W. Bush said, as you described, that the UN statement, I mean, the American statement in the UN, that Palestine would have to go through talks with Israel before anything would happen. And clearly that's not going to happen. It's outrageous to me to think, though, at this moment, seeing what we've been seeing for the last 6 months, that the United States in its recent statement would have the gall to say, well, you can't negotiate statehood, Palestine. You have to go through the same people that are dropping bombs on you and starving the people in Gaza at this moment.
And moreover, people have said they're not going to deal with you.
So what difference, John, would it make if things had gone differently, or if they will go differently in the near future, that if Palestine is granted full recognition as a freestanding state in the United Nations, what difference would that make to, say, what Israel is doing right now?
Well, it wouldn't bring about a sea change, to be sure. I think it would enhance Palestine's ability to navigate at the United Nations. It would put additional pressure on the United States to stop standing in the way of everything. I mean, what we're doing now is quite outrageous, that we are denying funds to the UN Relief and Works Agency at a time when the Palestinian people are starving to death. The recent publicity around the media coverage of what's going on in Congress now, the $26 billion that's going to Israel, the media doesn't seem to connect that to the fact that that money is being used, you know, to kill Palestinians.
Yeah, the removal of UNRWA, there was reports just the other day now, I think it was yesterday, that the claims made by Israel months ago that there were members of that organization, which is some 30,000 strong, as if memory serves, there was a small group, maybe a dozen claimed Israel, that were involved with Hamas in planning the attacks of October 7th. The report just released debunks that, as much has been much of what Israel has said has been debunked. And yet, as you described, the UNRWA is still being hamstrung.
Exactly. I mean, Israel has not come out with anything definitive about these people. The UN has fired them, the ones that were named. I mean, UNRWA is clearly the only agency that can effectively distribute aid. But, you know, the United States is doing everything it can to make it difficult for the aid to be distributed. I mean, what the United Nations should be doing is sending a peacekeeping force into Gaza to protect the Palestinian people, to protect them from violence, to ensure that their homes are not bombed. And actually, that's something not very dissimilar to what the United Nations did in 1956, when similarly Israel invaded Gaza. The United Nations set up a peacekeeping force that was stationed on the border between Gaza and Israel, and was there for almost, actually a decade. I mean, that is well within the power of the United Nations to do. And the reason that nothing is being pursued along those lines is that everyone knows that the United States would do everything it can to kill it.
Well, yeah, and there was a longstanding UN peacekeeping mission between Lebanon and Israel. I remember I believe it was 2006, Israel bombed one of the outposts, killing a Canadian soldier there and three others, if memory serves. And I think that led to the removal of peacekeepers between Lebanon and Israel. And as far as I recall, other than perhaps a tusking from the UN, there was never any sanction of Israel for its blatant murder of UN peacekeepers.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that is another example of a peacekeeping force that, you know, of the type that could be used in the current situation.
Well, to get a peacekeeping mission set up in Gaza now, that would necessarily go through the Security Council. The United States delegation there surprised everybody recently by not voting against, not vetoing a ceasefire resolution, but then had the curious addendum that the Security Council resolution was non-binding. I wasn't aware that UN Security Council resolutions were voluntary. Am I being naive, or have I been misled?
Well, there is a bit of semantics that relates to this. In theory, if the Security Council adopts a resolution under Chapter 7 of the Charter, it's binding. If it adopts it under Chapter 6, which gives the Security Council the power to make recommendations about, you know, war and peace situations, then that's not binding. And it's unclear sometimes whether a particular solution is under Chapter 7 or under Chapter 6. There's an argument that if it doesn't specify that it's under Chapter 7, then it's under Chapter 6. So that's the sticky wicket that you're getting stuck in, I'm afraid, and it's not your fault.
Well, and it's not Palestine's fault either. The shooting still continues. There doesn't seem the International Court of Justice has ruled that they believe what's happening in Gaza constitutes genocide, or at least is probable enough to trigger protections for the people, the Palestinian people in Gaza, not to mention the pogrom that is going on in the West Bank and East Jerusalem that is growing in intensity every day. But where are we then, John? Like, when legal institutions, one after the other, make rulings that Israel is just in contempt of, as in, for lack of another word, where are we in international law? What standing does international law have when one member state can just ignore everything that's issued, going right up to the very pinnacle of the United Nations?
Okay, yeah, that actually takes me back to the 1956 peacekeeping force. And actually, your word pinnacle. The pinnacle of the United Nations is not the Security Council. It is the General Assembly. And that's true, even though on war and peace issues, it's only the Security Council that can make decisions that are binding on member states. But in 1956, the peacekeeping mission was set up not by the Security Council, but rather by the General Assembly, because there had been an effort to do it in the Security Council, but France and Britain had vetoed it in the Security Council. So the General Assembly kind of took over and exercised its powers of recommendation, but that turned out to be sufficient to set up the operation. Similarly, that could be done right now. The General Assembly could set that up, and if it could get states to contribute to a mission, then that could be done.
Well, I've fallen into the trap of standing at the altar of the UN Security Council then. If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Guerrilla Radio. I'm speaking today with John B. Quigley. John's a professor emeritus of international law at Ohio State University's Moritz College of Law. He is the author of numerous publications, including books on international jurisprudence and articles on human rights, the United Nations War and Peace, East European Law, African Law, and the Arab-Israeli Conflict. We're talking today about the situation in Gaza and what restraint there is offered to stop what's going on right now. John, when you talk about the General Assembly being ascendant over the Security Council, despite my misgivings or misapprehension or misunderstanding, when you talk about using the going through the General Assembly, is this approaching the uniting for peace provision?
That, yes, would be one way to do it. That's a resolution that the General Assembly adopted in 1950 to say that when the Security Council is unable to deal with a war and peace situation because of a veto by a permanent member in the Security Council, that the General Assembly can take up the matter and can make recommendations. And that was the rubric under which the United Nations organized a military force in Korea that fought in Korea for 3 years. So be done. The other thing that the General Assembly can invoke relates to this question of Palestine membership at the United Nations. Article 4 of the Charter of the UN says, even without anything related to the Uniting for Peace resolution, that the General Assembly is the entity that admits states into membership of the United Nations. It does say that the General Assembly can do that upon recommendation of the Security Council, but no one has ever definitively figured out what that means and whether that means that it has to be a positive recommendation, whether it means a recommendation one way or the other. So it seems to me that right now one could do what has been proposed within the last week by the Prime Minister of Ireland, and that is that the General Assembly should admit Palestine as a member state and forget about what the Security Council has or has not done.
Well, and that brings me back again to what difference would that make? Would that provide any greater protection for the Palestinian people in international law that if it was recognized as a state, provisions that can't be enacted now when they're just people under a occupation, which is another point I'd like to get to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think, you know, your point is well taken that technically it wouldn't make any real difference, except perhaps you now would be talking about the derogation of rights of a member state, which makes it a bit more significant for the United Nations. So I think it's something that would add pressure against the United States, but only as part of a more general effort on the part of member states to decide that they needed to do something real.
Well, the High Commissioner, Volker Türk, the United Nations Human Rights High Commissioner, he came out blasting yesterday. There's been discoveries again of mass graves outside the Nasser Hospital this time. At last count, it was more than 300 bodies, many of them bound, many showing evidence of what was described in the news as field executions or being shot while bound and buried in a mass grave. Israel, of course, is denying this. The commissioner has called for independent investigations, but in reading his release, I didn't see anywhere where he mentioned who would conduct these investigations or who has the stature that the findings would be accepted or respected. Do you know who that independent body might be, John?
Well, there is a body that the Human Rights Council set up several years ago, specifically for Gaza, in the light of the Israeli incursion back then, which was in 21. So there is a commission of inquiry, it's called. It has three members. It continues to be in existence, and it is fully capable of carrying out that investigation.
Well, outside, John, of the United Nations, now there's the Geneva Convention. In the press briefings in the United States, there's a growing trend to question the administration on whether or not it accepts the Geneva Conventions as they would apply in Gaza. Specifically, they seem to be slippery on the terms of whether or not Israel is an occupying power. The Geneva Convention states in Article 4 that an occupying force is responsible for the well-being of the people that it's occupying. Israel seems to be denying that it is an occupying power, and America, the American the current administration spokespeople, at least, are trying to evade that definition as well. Can you describe what difference it makes and what the administration here is apparently trying to evade?
Yeah, this is an outrageous situation that the State Department is not willing to say that Israel is an occupying power, that it is in the status of a belligerent occupant, that is so under the Fourth Geneva Convention of 1949. The organization Accuracy in Media has been pressing the United States Department of State on this issue. And as you accurately say, they've been talking around it. They haven't denied that Israel is a belligerent occupant, but they've been unwilling to actually say those words, that it is a belligerent occupant. And that, of course, imposes rather major requirements on a state when it is in belligerent occupancy, to protect the population, as you say, under the Geneva Convention. So this seems to be a way on the part of the State Department of avoiding a way of saying that Israel is in violation of international law.
Well, regardless of the status of the people in Gaza have been there's been tens of thousands killed, hundreds of thousands displaced, millions displaced. Now they've been kettled. The population has largely been kettled down into the southern quarter near the city of Rafah. There's indications today that Israel's long threatened invasion, full out military invasion of the city, filled to overflowing with some estimates of 1.5 million people that are defenseless largely against this. What kind of force of law, John, can be invoked to protect these people, whether they're occupied or not? They're still people, and there must be mechanisms to protect the civilian population somewhere. I mean, what can be done?
Well, under the Fourth Geneva Convention, there is a mechanism, and that is that all of the states that are party to the Fourth Geneva Convention, which is virtually every state, they have a collective responsibility to ensure that the convention is being complied with whenever it applies. And sporadically, this has been invoked, but never has anything serious been done. It was invoked in 1974 when Mr. Arafat was first accepting the possibility of a Palestine state in only Gaza and the West Bank. But this really does involve an obligation, a legal obligation on the part of all states to ensure that the convention be complied with. This more or less would dovetail with a Uniting for Peace action through the United Nations. It would be all the same countries, but in any event would require their cooperation and require an initiative And at this point, apparently would require that it be done without the United States participation.
John, finally, in the United States right now, you're an academician. The universities are in turmoil. It's starting to smell a little bit like 1968 for people gray enough to remember what happened then. What's your impression, John, of what's going on at campuses across the country right now, where supporters of Palestine are digging in to hopefully pressure the government to bring an end to this catastrophe?
Well, it does remind one of 1968 and 1970, when there was widespread angst over what the United States was doing in Vietnam. It's really reached that level on the campuses of universities. And I think that's what the Biden people are trying to tamp down or ignore, and that they don't really get that is the sentiment that they are dealing with.
In Gaza itself, every single university has been reduced to rubble, flat ground. Professors have been assassinated, kidnapped, tortured. Students cast asunder, as I said in the introduction. As an educator, John, what can you give me a final sentiment on what we're witnessing there? Something that I can't remember seeing in any other conflict.
Right, I haven't either. Comparisons are sometimes drawn to the city of Mosul in Iraq, where you know the U.S. went in and, you know, to remove ISIS, but I can't think of another situation where a state has gone in not just to kill the people, but to destroy the whole place. I mean, the Israeli military is pulling up the pavement on roads in Gaza. That's something I have never seen done in warfare before. I might be wrong about that, but I don't think we have seen bulldozers going in to do that. That's the extent of the destruction that is being wrought upon Gaza. Water pipes are being dug up. I mean, they're just trying to make it so that there is no possibility of a population inhabiting the area.
Yes, the war against the future. There's a term that's been coined for what's happening there, at least as far as universities go, and it is scholasticide. We hope that we don't see something similar, if not as drastic, in the United States and Canada at our universities, where educators are being intimidated, students are being face of recognition identified, and their futures being threatened for standing up for the right cause, and especially in this case, one so obvious, where a genocide come Holocaust is going on right before our eyes, and our governments are all failing to do anything about it. John B. Quigley, I thank you very much for coming on. You're the author of many books, as I elucidated some of them in the introduction. Can you give us finally an indication? How do people find your writings? How would you suggest they go about that?
Oh, they're available in the usual places, major libraries. Have them. They're all on Amazon for purchase. So they're not too hard to find.
That's John B. Quigley. John, thanks a lot for coming on. I want everyone else to stay tuned because Dimitri Lascaris is up after the break. I'm going to be speaking with Dimitri from a boat en route to Gaza from Turkey as part of the peace flotilla. Thanks again, John, for coming on, eh?
Thank you.
Their message always to everybody through all their advertising, all their PR, everything is, we are your friends. And it's like, no, you are not our friends. Friends are not people whose bottom line is how much profit they can make out of you. It is completely different.
Guerrilla Radio, knowing who our real friends are since 1999.
We're running out of time to put out a fire.
I woke up one morning with an email in my inbox containing lies and slander known locally as bollocks. I was about to tour in England, singing songs about the Holocaust in Gaza, when one of the venues pulled out. They had gotten a